Elementary music teacher friend, you love what you do, but you might feel unappreciated and, in fact, unseen some days. You may even feel like you're on a music teacher island and just want to connect with other music teachers who can relate to both your struggles and wins when it comes to teaching elementary music. I get you and understand completely the feelings you're having. That's why each and every week, the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast will provide you with solo and guest episodes that will help you realize you're not alone in your music teaching journey. Throughout each episode, my goal is for you to be able to walk away with actionable steps and ideas to help you feel like you're ready to take on the new week with whatever challenges may be thrown your way. Hi, I'm your host, Jessica Paresta, and I'm so glad you're here. Whether you're at home, in your car, in the shower, or wherever else you're listening, grab your cup of coffee or whatever other beverage is nearby and listen in to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. Welcome back to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. I am joined today by Dr. Erin Parks. I'm super excited to have her. We are going to talk about a whole lot, and I want her to just start by introducing herself and letting you all know about her work and what she does in the world of music education. So welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. So my work is almost entirely in special music education. So really just music education for students with special needs or exceptionalities or whatever your preferred term is. I got into this, I've been teaching for 25 years and I've really been teaching students with exceptionalities that whole time. But it really came to the forefront of my work about 11 or 12 years ago when I was, sending out applications to do my PhD in music education. And at that time, even though I had taught a lot of students with exceptionalities and really enjoyed it, it wasn't on my radar, honestly, as even a thing you could do. Like, I didn't know that was something you could specialize in or that, that it was kind of its own thing. So I was just, I was looking more at, just general things in music education. But as I was applying for my PhD, my youngest son, who's now almost 16, was diagnosed with autism. And so, of course, as a mom, all my time and energy was dedicated to researching autism and finding activities for him. He was four at the time. And those two things converged where, I in my research, I started to see the, really strong affinity for music that a lot of people with autism have and the, extraordinary abilities and different ways of processing and all of that. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, I was encountering so many instances of trying to find activities for my son and coming up short because, trying to sign him up for martial arts or swimming lessons or summer camp or anything where, people had really good intentions sometimes, but didn't know how to support him. And it always ended in, tears and it all fell apart. And, so that kind of led me on this journey to wanting to create a safe space for students with exceptionalities where parents knew that teachers were going to understand and accept, their child, but also that we really could offer the best possible music education, that we, we're looking at research and all of that to make sure that the adaptive approach that we were taking was going to help each student reach their full potential. Mm-hmm. And so that really kind of became my mission in my PhD. And since then, in starting Lotus Center for Special Music Education, that's what we're all about, is just meeting that need in a lot of different ways. Actually, we have, direct service programs, which is really music lessons. We do outreach where we work with schools, either going into schools that don't have their own music programs and basically being the music teacher in autism classroom or different classrooms, or working with, the teachers to help them incorporate music, putting on sensory friendly concerts, but also a lot of work in research into best practices and adaptive approaches that work so that we can kind of inform the broader community. And professional development is really, really close to my heart. That was the topic of my doctoral work, was training teachers to work with students with autism. And I see that as the biggest game changer in providing access because, you know, we have our studio. It's in Ottawa, Canada. You know, we work with a number of students there, but it's got four walls. We can only work right. with so many students there, you know. Yeah. But the more teachers we can train that then I feel equipped to do this work, you know, then that's going to have a huge ripple effect. So in all these different ways, you know, I'm doing everything I can to create more opportunities for music learning for students with exceptionalities.
I love that. I love the work you're doing. You may or may not know this about me, but my oldest son has autism. That's why I was nodding my head. Listeners, you can't see that, but I was nodding my head the entire time. He's 11 now, got diagnosed at 5, and same. I felt kind of like, this is odd because I have an education degree. Shouldn't I know what to do as his mom? Shouldn't I know what to say in these IEP meetings and all the things? And there's not a lot of training even for teachers to work with kids, you know, on the spectrum or with any, you know, different ability. And so thank you for the work you're doing because I know completely where, for example, he had a music teacher in school who did not know what to do. She was not following his IEP. She, in fact, he did not get, they did, you know, ES, like letter grades, not ABCs, but like he didn't get like a passing grade in her class. And I remember having a conversation in his meeting, like, listen, hold on a minute. So then his recent music teacher, he was in a academically linked classroom where he would travel to music with his other two fifth graders that were in his classroom. It was just kids who learned just like him. And he would travel to this, to the music classroom with them to meet up with another fifth grade class. And she was incredible. It's like, she just, I don't know what she did like to get to that point, but she just knew what to do with him, was so patient. And I don't fault the teacher for not knowing the first one I mentioned, but it's also like, I think like you said, I think a lot of times it's just, they don't know what to do. I'm not sure it can come across for my son. I can speak to this as a defiance thing or looking like he just doesn't want to participate or he's over here stuck on the first thing activity they were doing when everybody else is on step three. And it's not that but there's also not a lot of time in the day for music teachers to see these students and learn about them. And so I've had this conversation with so many music teachers where I think back to my experience going through my bachelor's program for music education, and there was one total class about all the different abilities you may come into contact with. And you're like, although I learned about it was so quick. And, you know, it's just kind of getting in there as you get into the classroom where I started, oh, this child needs this, or same thing, research. I have this child, like, what do I do with them? I don't, you know. So anyways, all that to say, I do agree with you in the fact that I feel like music teachers, a lot of times it's not for lack of not wanting to help students. It's just the fact that they don't know how. And so I'm just kind of going to go there with you for a minute. What advice do you give to these teachers where they do just kind of feel stuck or like, I didn't get the right training? Like, what are some steps they can take to move forward with their students they see?
Yeah. And that is a huge issue. Cause like you said, you're lucky, honestly, that you even had a class because a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it depends where you are too, right? Mm-hmm. Like in different countries and different parts of the world. So, and especially depending on what you're teaching or where you're teaching, like if you're a studio music teacher, you might not have an education degree and might have nothing, but you're still going to get these students. Right. So,
yes.
I think training is really important. I mean, there are more and more and more resources out there. Even in the 10, 11, 12 years that I've been doing it, there's so much more. Like when I started, there was hardly anything. And now there's a lot. And it's so amazing to see that teachers and, you know, professors and, you know, everybody's really picking up on, like, these students have potential too, and they have a right to learn music too. And it's our job as educators to make it work for them, you mm-hmm. know? And I think mm-hmm. there's starting to be that shift in this sort of, if I can say this, elitism yeah, yes. of music, you know, like mm-hmm. a lot of music ed is to kind of like weed out the non-serious students, unfortunately. And, you know, I think that that's shifting a little bit. And I think more and more teachers now just want to reach all the students, you know, as best they can.
Yeah.
So, you know, at Lotus Center, we just started an Institute for Professional Development, and it really is, you know, my attempt to kind of fill that gap as much as I can, and, you know, offering different levels of courses too, because the thing is, you know, not everybody has time to go back to school and get a, you know, get a master's degree or do intensive courses or something. You might just want to seek out a webinar, you know, you have 1 hour and you want to learn, you know, you have one specific student that you want to learn about. So there are more of those resources out there, and definitely seeking them out is a good start. But I think even underneath it all, coming at it with a heart of really wanting to understand and a curiosity about it too, because I think particularly with students with high behavioral needs, I don't know if this was your son, but it definitely was mine that, you know, he would get overwhelmed or, you know, and then he would have quite severe behaviors, and we never saw it at all at home because he was very regulated at home. And I, you know, I'm his mom and I knew how to keep him regulated and we had everything in place, but school was just a lot for him.
Yeah.
And no matter what they tried to put in place, they couldn't take away that school was a lot for him. And so he was reactive, but he was not a bad kid and he couldn't control it, you know? And I see a lot of teachers kind of like, nope, that's a hard no. If they throw something, then I'm done with them, without looking at, well, listen, it doesn't feel good for that kid. If they're like, imagine yourself, we've all felt that way where we've been so like frustrated or angry or overwhelmed that we want to throw something, right?
Oh, yes.
it doesn't feel good. It feels awful. Yeah. That's how that kid is feeling. You know, they're not trying to bother you or upset you. They're that distressed that's how they're acting right now. And so I think just having that lens of, oh, this kid is struggling with something. And I think that that can lead down a path of, well, let me see what I can do to support this student then.
Yeah. And you may not have all the answers right away, or, and it's okay to not. And I feel like a lot of teachers need to hear that, you know.
For sure.
I know for me personally, that's my personality. I want to know how to do it all right away. And if I don't know how, I beat myself up about it. But you're always learning and growing, you know, as a professional, and that's a good thing. And so maybe you're not sure quite what to do with a specific student. And maybe, I know I've heard this too, and I know you do, you know, working with teachers, you hear this a lot, is, but I have a classroom full of kids. If I have that one child who needs individual attention and I don't have an aide coming into my class, what am I supposed to do? So what advice do you give around that when there is, you know, a child who needs some extra guidance or help or support? How can a music teacher do that while they have a classroom full of other students as well?
Yeah, and that is really tough. It's so much easier if, I mean, and different schools and different kids have different levels of support, right? And sometimes the kids have the support that they need, and sometimes, unfortunately, it's not possible, right?
Yeah.
And music is often one of the places in the curriculum where they integrate, right? Like often that's where they put kids to have an opportunity to be with their peers. But it is difficult because then a lot of teachers too, and I don't know if this has been your experience, but I hear from a lot of teachers that they're not getting the IEPs. They're not necessarily seeing everything, right? So even though it's their classroom where the kids are being integrated, they're kind of left out of that whole process and they don't know what's up. So I think number one is, you know, trying to, if you can, if you have control over this, have those open communication channels with your principal or, you know, your resource teacher, whoever in your school can tell you about this student. It could be their homeroom teacher, because often, you know, they get to know the student really well. Because, you know, the fact is that even if you're with the student all day, every day, it still takes a lot to get to understand them and everything. And it's going to be really hard to get there if you're just seeing them for a couple hours a week, right? Mm-hmm. So getting those tips, you know, what triggers this student, what works for this student, you know, what are some things that the student really enjoys? Do they enjoy the opportunity to be a leader, for example? You know, for a lot of kids, that works really well. Do they get overwhelmed with a lot of sound? Do I need to seat them in the room, you know, away from the like trombones or something, you know, so that they have some space? Do they need noise canceling headphones? You know, do they have sensory issues that maybe would make it difficult for them to be playing a brass instrument or something like that, you know, that doesn't necessarily feel good. All of those things are information that you should be able to get, you know, sometimes in an IEP, but at least with conversations. And then, you know, it is really hard depending on the makeup of your class. But I think, again, like you said, really understanding that trial and error is kind of the name of the game, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. It's okay to try something and be like, whoops, nope, that didn't work, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's okay. That's part of the process. Don't feel like you have to know it all, but mm-hmm. you know, then go back. And I can tell also as a parent, I really appreciate it when, you know, all the teachers contact me. Like, you know, I always have contact with the homeroom teachers, but I'm really happy when a music teacher or a phys ed teacher or whatever reaches out and says, hey, you know, so-and-so is struggling. What can I do? Don't be afraid if you have parent contact info to reach out to them as well. They'd probably be really grateful, you know, to have the opportunity for that input.
Oh, for sure. Because I know for a fact, I would rather teachers email and ask me how to specifically work with my child than just not do it and just assume that their behavior is whatever it is. And that's, you know, that goes for a lot of parents for different, you know, students you contact or that you come into contact with is what I mean. Now, that's not always going to be the case. There's going to be some parents who don't respond, but you don't know, just like we talked about earlier, until you try. But most of the time, parents are, we're our kiddos' biggest advocates, and we want the best for them. And we are there to support our kiddos just as much as we want you to as teachers. So I love that advice. That's amazing. And I completely agree 100%. Okay. So I want to talk about, you mentioned this a minute ago, when it comes to kids with sensory issues. I know when we were talking about this interview, you love to talk about sensory processing and kind of how it can impact learning, specifically when it comes to music. So what are some tips or advice you have around kids who maybe do have sensory processing or sensory issues?
Yeah, this is such an important topic. And I'm always surprised how little attention it's given that the music is such a sensory art, right? And I mean, it's a multi-sensory art. I mean, it's obviously an oral art, but also, you know, visually we're looking at printed scores most of the time, and it's very kinesthetic. There's movement. There's so much sensory input involved in it. And so that can be wonderful because, you know, it can give us a lot of opportunity to control the sensory input, but it also can be overwhelming. So we have to be really careful with it. And different, so there are a lot of different diagnoses that have a sensory component. For sure, autism. Most kids with autism, or adults as well with autism, have sensory processing challenges. Definitely ADHD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, all kinds of diagnoses have different issues with sensory processing. And I think the number one thing to point out, to kind of right off the bat, is that it's not always that kids are hypersensitive. Mm-hmm. Like, I go to a lot of classrooms where they're trying to be, you know, sensory friendly, and it's like everything's quiet and the lights are low. But then you have kids like spinning like tops because they're trying to create their, like, they need more, you know, and no one's giving it to them. And so that kind of like low sensory input will work for some kids, but for others, they need more. So it can be either that they're hyper or hyposensitive, that they need more or less. What is, you know, the main crux of it is that what they need is more specific. Mm-hmm. And it's referred to as the optimal zone of arousal, which is your, you know, everybody's baseline for where they function the best. And so, you know, if you're a person that, you know, works your best if you're in a busy cafe, like if you need to really like hammer something out, you go to a cafe where there's noise around you and, you know, you can hear people talking and everything, and that's how you get in your zone, then you have kind of a higher optimal zone. You need a lot of arousal to be at your best. But then some people, like, I'm not like that. I can't function like that. I need it like quiet in my house, you know? So mine's lower. And if I'm trying to work in a cafe, I can't do it. Like, I can't concentrate, you know? So that optimal zone, everybody has it. But for a lot of our students with sensory processing, it's very specific and it's usually narrower. So even though we all have it, We all have, you know, where we function best. Most of us can kind of function in a pretty big range, you know, even if we're not at our best. But for some of our students, they can only function in this narrow range. And if they go up above it, then they go into kind of a fight or flight response. And if they go down below it, then they're going to start doing a lot of sensory seeking, maybe to get themselves back into it. And either of those can lead to behaviors that you might see. Like if they're sensory seeking, that's where you see, you know, students getting up and running around or grabbing things, or they just kind of are, you know, their movements are really hard or fast, you know, or spinning upside down, you know, kids doing that, or just fidgeting. And we all do it, right? Yeah. Like if we're in a boring lecture or something, we start doodling or something. That's trying to get ourselves up into that zone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I need to pay attention. Let me do something to, like, you know, keep that spark. But also if you get overwhelmed, then like I was saying earlier, when you feel like, oh, I'm so frustrated, I could throw something. Or if you've been like, I don't know, Boxing Day shopping or something, and yeah, you're like, if somebody touches me, I'm going to lose it. That's how a lot of our students feel all the time, because they're taking in so much sensory input. And so we have to be very cautious with not getting them to that point of, mm-hmm, now they've gone too far and they're in fight or flight, because that's when we do see sometimes aggressive behaviors or running. But also in terms of learning, you just can't concentrate. You, like, your brain is not functioning at its best, mm-hmm, when you're in either of those places. So, you know, at the most severe, it can be behavioral issues, but it can also just be really difficulties concentrating. And that's why with students with ADHD, often we have like the fidget cubes and stuff like that, right? Because that helps them, that gives them the stimulation while they're working to be able to continue to work. Or there's things like you can put bands around chairs. That's better for music because you can kind of do it with your feet while you're playing an instrument or whatever. Or there's little like cushions you can put on your seat that are kind of like squishy, and that just gives some stimulation while you're just sitting there. And that keeps them seeking out the stimulation and helps them to stay in their optimal zone. But the thing is, it does take a little bit of detective work to like figure out, right? Like, I mean, you can't tell by looking at a student, oh, they're hypersensitive to this and hyposensitive to, like, you have to really be very observant. When students, you know, when you try something and you're not really sure, you know, is my student hypersensitive or hyposensitive? All you can do is try these different things, right? Because sometimes one might look a lot like the other. Like sensory seeking, like running around grabbing things, can also be like hyperstimulation. Like, you know how kids, like at the end of a day at like an amusement park, they're like wired and spinning until they crash.
Oh my gosh, yes. So
it's like that, right? But you want to bring them down before the crash. But they can look similar. So it is just kind of trial and error. But this is where communication with other teachers or parents and stuff can help a lot too.
Yeah. And that, like you said, goes back to knowing your students and giving it time to get to know them. And teachers, you are legally allowed to see the students' IEPs, 504 plans, whatever it might be, and just ask. You know, you may be, like you said earlier, you may not even know if a student is on a particular plan, but maybe just ask that teacher, their classroom teacher, like, hey, is there something about the student I should know? And then the next step is, can I see their IEP plan if they're on one? Because that'll help you, because they'll have strategies in there that help the students, which may or may not work in music, but you can look at it and kind of go, okay, it says to do this in the classroom. How can I adapt this in the music room to help this child? And so I think the problem is a lot of times music teachers maybe don't know they are legally allowed to see those. They're just not usually a bit like given it, like, oh, let me pass this out to all the teachers. I know that's happened in, you know, in the States, it happens a lot where they're just not, I don't know why. It's frustrating because you're like, if I'm seeing these children, I should be able to know. I remember having revelations about my own students when I would finally find out information about them and be like, well, no wonder. Or if I had known that, it would have really helped me to be able to reach this child and know what to do with them. So let's, like, for example, if an elementary music teacher is doing instruments, let's just say rhythm sticks. I'm just going to throw that out as an example. How, with a child that has some sensory processing things, when a child is maybe hitting their sticks together before they're supposed to, or they're like twirling them in the air, or like twirling, you know, spinning them on the floor, What suggestions do you have for that teacher to be able to, is it just patience that they need to have with this child, or is there a way to, you know, because I can see, because I've heard this happen too. Students are like, why do they get to spin their sticks and we have to keep ours still? So what are just some kind of, I'm just throwing out a random example, but what is a way a teacher could help that student in the music room?
Yeah, no, it's a good example because it's something like that comes up how often, like that exact thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, it's always really, for me, a balance between structure and flexibility mm-hmm. and boundaries. And this is also where, you know, it's really important to be your authentic self in your teaching. Like your boundaries are your boundaries. And yes, you need to take into account what the student is capable of. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to set boundaries or set expectations that they can't meet. That doesn't help anybody. But, you know, if you feel that the student is able to stop spinning their sticks, you just have to put things in place to help them get there, then you should do that. Don't feel like because it's harder for them that you're just going to let it go. I think that definitely having really, really, really clear rules around that and consistent, you know, implementation of them is important. So right from the beginning, you know, okay, I'm handing out the sticks. Sticks go on your lap. Like say it before they even get it.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you see them picking up their sticks, oh, remember sticks go on your lap or I'm going to take your sticks. You know, like that's how it goes. Like put them on your lap or you're going to lose them.
Yeah.
But if they really, really do need some other kind of sensory input, then again, that's where like a squishy seat or something like that, they might need it. But I totally get your point that when you have other students in the room, you don't want it to be the case that the rules are different for this mm-hmm. student. Probably this student should get their sticks last and like hand them out, you know, because you don't want to give them lots of opportunity if you know it's going to be a challenge. And because the fact is, if you have a student with ADHD or something and you know, impulse control issues, it is going to be hard for them. Who doesn't want to start banging their sticks? Of course they do, you know? So like, if you know they're going to have a hard time, then don't put them in that situation. But be very consistent with what the rules are beforehand, what the consequence is going to be if they can't, you know, meet that expectation. And then also when it comes to actually doing it, like if you're doing a piece or whatever with the rhythm sticks, keeping it very, very structured. So if you have a lot of like free play or something, that can be very overwhelming and again can lead to like a lot of kind of spinning out of control. So really, really structured, you know, like it doesn't need to necessarily be that everybody's playing at the same time in the same rhythm.
Yeah.
But I would try to have it, you know, that it's very clear who's supposed to play when. Improvisation and stuff is great, but that I think anything like that needs to be pretty tightly structured. Or it can just be very hard for some of these students to put those boundaries on themselves or to see where those boundaries are if they're not crystal clear and consistent. So having that there all the time is really important. You may also want to have some sort of visual representation of the rules, like have them written out, point to them if you need to. You might even want to just give that to that student. You know, maybe they need to have it right with them because sometimes that distance in the classroom, you know, from where they're sitting to the whiteboard or whatever can be a lot. It might seem like for you, that perception is easy, but for some of our students, that visual perception is difficult. So maybe having a little, you know, cue card on their desk with all the rules, you know, will help them out. That those kinds of supports are pretty simple, you know, like being mindful of the fact that if you have 30 kids in your class, then it has to be simple supports, right? You can't sit with the student the whole time.
Right.
But doing those kinds of things can help a lot. And actually putting in those structures can benefit a lot of the kids in your class, because even going back to your point about, you know, who has an IEP, sometimes you don't know. I also want to, you know, on the flip side, say that just because a student doesn't have an IEP, don't assume, well, then I guess they're just fine and are just being difficult.
Yes.
Because I see that a lot too. Well, if parents haven't told us that they have something, then I guess they don't. Well, no, often the road to diagnosis is very long. Sometimes parents are not as savvy about these things and just don't know what they're looking at, you know? Mm-hmm. So I would still just treat, you know, just support the students' needs as you see them. Like, it can be helpful to have a diagnosis or have an IEP because it lays out, here's the diagnosis, this is what it means, here's the IEP, here are some things that help. But if you see a student that's struggling, you know, just support them as they need it.
Yes, I agree with that completely. The road to getting a child diagnosed is long. It is tiring. And I know firsthand there are sometimes parents where, like you said, maybe they're not aware that there is an issue, or they may be a parent that just chose to not go down that road to get a diagnosis for whatever reason, you know, no fault. It just sometimes I know there would be a suggestion brought up like, hey, can we meet about your child or get, you know, testing started? I don't want to do that. Okay. So, you know, but it is still, like you said, the job of the teacher to still educate every single child you see. And you can't just teach one way. And that's why I'm really big on student-centered approach, because it's, you know, if it's just the teacher standing at the front of the classroom and presenting the lesson, and you're going to lose half the class because you're going to have some spinning, some not looking at you, some poking their neighbor, whatever. And of course, a little of that is necessary in order to present the lesson and to teach. But I truly do believe that presenting a lot of different ways of learning music, that's going to help reach all the kids and in different ways. But also, one thing that worked phenomenally well for me was when I did partner activities or small group activities, was to kind of, without the kids even knowing I'm doing this, but I kind of would on purpose put kids together that I knew would be able to help other students. Like, it was like a perfect blend kind of situation. And you would see these kids watching the leader in that group without me even saying, that's the leader. And they would kind of follow suit and want to participate and be doing, like, the student was like, no, we're doing this. They would kind of keep them on track, and it worked really well. So is that a suggestion you would say is something that works well too? Like, kind of sometimes have the students involved.
Yeah, for sure. And even outside of group work, like even just in strategic seating, you know, seating these students close to each other, because there are often, well, always, I think in every classroom, there are those students that, you know, like to help and mentor and kind of have that natural nurturing of others, you know, and that can be, you know, that can be such a beautiful thing to nurture in your classroom anyway, right? I mean, of course, for us as teachers, that's our job and we want to do that. But to facilitate that between peers, and especially, you know, for some of our students with exceptionalities, they may struggle with that. They may not connect really well with that, their peers. So if we can help set up a situation where they are connecting with their peers, you know, and they're getting support and creating relationships, then that's beneficial all around. And it can be very regulating for them too, you know, to be with a student. Like, even, like I said, just sitting beside them, it doesn't even need to always be more than that, but sitting beside a student that's very composed and sort of self-reliant, and, you know, that co-regulation is something that, you know, is very much a developmental stage, right? Like babies and toddlers, like when a baby's crying and you pick them up and you go shh and you rub their back, it's you kind of regulating them, you know, because they can't do it yet. And for a lot of our students with exceptionalities, they still struggle with that, with regulating themselves. So the more proximity they can have to people that are well regulated, that does a lot just in kind of bringing things down, and vice versa, right? Like when you put a bunch of kids together that all kind of can be, you know, a little bit more excitable, then it breeds itself, right? Like it grows and grows and grows. So, you know, being mindful of that, I think, makes a big, big difference.
Yes. So you brought up earlier about, you know, the kiddos get, sometimes you just see the behavior, but you don't really see what's behind it. And so when kind of approaching behavior challenges, why is it important to take an empathy-based approach?
I think it's critical for the teachers, you know, well-being, and for the student, because for me, the only way really to approach behavioral issues is to understand what's underneath them, because otherwise you're not solving the problem. The problem is not the behavior. Like if a student got frustrated and throws a maraca in class, that's not really the problem. It's not the throwing that's the problem. It's what is the student feeling and experiencing that led them to throw that. That's the problem. That, like, throwing a maraca is a problem.
Right.
But the thing is, if all you do is tell them no throwing and then expect they should just stop now, I told them no. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't throw it for fun. They threw it probably because something was going on. You haven't fixed that. So they're probably going to do it again. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah. To solve the problem, empathy is important because you're trying to connect with what is this student feeling and experiencing right now? And that connection and that kind of curiosity and that I want to make them feel better. I want to help them out of this distress. I want to help them to, you know, be the best that they can be and set them up for success, which is what we all want to do, I think, with our students. Mm-hmm. You have to do that when a student is in distress, I think, to have empathy for them. But also for us as teachers, I think, because I don't want to minimize that it is tough to work with students with difficult behaviors, you know, mm-hmm. especially if you do have students that can be aggressive or, you know, be very disruptive in class. Like, you know, I don't say just be empathetic, like, you know, to wash away your own feelings of frustration.
Right.
Because that's real. But taking an empathy-based approach can really help diffuse that too, I find, you know, because if you're looking at it as, well, this child is really struggling with something right now, it kind of diffuses that frustration of this child's being difficult right now, mm-hmm. right? Because that's usually where that frustration comes from. If you're thinking someone's really struggling, you're less likely to be angry or frustrated with them. You're more likely to feel something for them and want to help them. Mm. And I think that empathy really leads to that. And beyond that, it's just such an important part of relationship building with the students. You know, some of these students, I hate to say it, and I experienced it as a mom too, but some of them have not been given a lot of empathy, you know,
yes.
because they can be maybe a little prickly sometimes. And it can be really life-altering for them when someone does connect with them that way and says, hey, I see that you're having a hard time. Mm-hmm. Let me help you. How can I help you? What can we do here? Is it this that's bothering you? Let's put this in place. That makes a huge impact, you know? And so both in terms of the relationship and you know, the well-being for you and your student, but then also from a more practical sense of actually, you know, improving the conditions and the learning outcomes for your students. It's so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these kiddos want to be seen and heard and acknowledged and loved just like any other child you come into contact with. And one way my son, he has had anger outbursts, but one way that he's kind of like the quiet behavior issues. What I mean by that is he will cry. And sometimes we're just like, what's wrong? And he can't verbalize it right away. He is verbal, but he can't tell us right away like what's going on. And then after we just kind of give him time to settle down, and then he'll voice like why he's frustrated. And it can be something kind of minor, but to him, it's a big deal. And so I know in a music class, he's voiced this to me before. Like, for example, when they were learning recorder, I just played it. I didn't really think about all the steps that went into it. You know, even when I would play clarinet in band, I didn't really think about it. I just did it. But there is so much that it's involved with a lot going on in the music room. And with recorder, it is, you know, from putting it together to where your fingers go. And they're telling you to put, like, it even bothered them. They were telling him to put circles on his fingers. That bothered him because he did sensory stuff. You know, and then reading the music, counting the music, how to play it with your mouth. It just became just, and so that's just an example. But there's a lot of things. If you see a kid, like you said, maybe reacting or quietly crying, or maybe they're just like not moving or sitting still and they're refusing to participate. A lot of times it could be due to just frustration, or maybe, I know music class is very fast paced because you only see the kids for whatever however many minutes a time a week. But for some of these kids, if there's so many steps to keep up with, I love how you said you could give them even like, this is what we're doing today. Have it written on the board or have it next to them so they could even check it off, or put like a sticker next to what they're doing next or something like that so they can keep track of what's going on. Because I know, you know, and that goes back to every child learns differently anyways. Some are more visual, some are auditory, some are kinesthetic, whatever. But yeah, the behavior, like you said, don't just skate over it and just be like, oh, well, you threw a maraca, better next time. But of course, that's not okay. But like you said, getting to know what is going on with this kid? And maybe you're not going to know right away. Maybe they're not going to tell you right away. And maybe it's up to you to kind of, like you said earlier, be a detective to figure out what is going on. Why would they be so frustrated? It could be the playing the instrument or the other instruments being played around that child were loud, or they didn't know how to play it and sing at the same time. And that was frustrating for them. Or maybe they were told to play the instrument and walk around the room and do some movement activity or whatever. So thinking about kind of like dissecting your lesson that day and saying, what were the steps leading up to this? And why did this frustration happen? I think it will just go so far. It just really will. Yeah.
Yeah. And you made a really good point there about, you know, I didn't even realize how many things were involved. And like often when I do training with teachers, I'm like, okay, your instrument, whatever your main instrument is, what are the skills you need to play it? And, you know, I'm like, nope, more, there's more. Nope, go deeper. Yeah. Because we just do it, right? And becomes so natural that you kind of forget, or even for those of us that didn't struggle with learning, you know, maybe like reading music was very easy, but for a student with dyslexia, it's going to be really challenging. And you don't really realize, even just in music reading, what are all the things really involved in music reading? There's a whole lot, a whole lot.
Oh yeah.
And just understanding that, just taking the time to break down what are all of the components that I'm teaching, because the way that you're breaking it down for the majority may not work. You might need to break it down times 10 for this student. And if you do that, then everything will be okay, you know, but it is kind of, you have to do that thinking first, because I find that that's where I've improved a lot over the years with my teaching, is breaking things down more and more and more and more and more as I realize how much that's needed for some students. But also then it does help you to kind of, like you said, go back and be like, okay, what then are the components that maybe tripped this student up? And you can cross-reference that with like an IEP too, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, now I know they're going to maybe struggle with note reading or visual spatial things or whatever, then I'm going to have to break this part down more. Or, oh, I see when I introduced this, they started to, you know, exhibit some frustration or whatever. But that breaking down piece is really important.
Yeah. This conversation has been so great, and we could go on it for hours and hours and hours. But do you have any advice to give the listeners about anything we talked about today, or any other things you want to touch on that maybe we didn't even cover?
I think one thing that I want to say, because I see it come up a lot too in like teacher groups or Facebook or whatever, is really honoring yourself and your own boundaries, but also your own triggers. And knowing that that's okay. But, you know, trying to, because I think that a lot of teachers either just kind of shut down and are like, this student is really difficult, or they feel like they should just kind of accept everything that's happening. And there's a balance in between, but I just want to, you know, caution that as much as I say, I do this, or you do this, or different teachers say this, you're the teacher in your class. You have your own feelings around things. It's okay to have your own boundaries, but also, you know, your own self-care, because a lot of teachers I know, especially if you are, you know, if you happen to be listening to this and you work in a special needs classroom, maybe, and you're working with a lot of high need students, there are high levels of burnout there. So, you know, just practicing self-care and kind of acknowledging your own feelings, and those are really important components to being an effective teacher, because you need to do that to be at your best for your students, but also just to take care of yourself and be at your best in it so that you can continue to support your students. You know, compassion fatigue is real. Caregivers, parents experience it a lot, special needs parents, but also special needs educators experience it a lot. So, you know, just that's something to be mindful of. And if you're feeling that way, that's totally normal, but, you know, just to be aware of it and to, you know, honor those feelings as well.
Oh, so good. Thank you so much for bringing those points to the surface. It's so true. Teachers are so hard on ourselves. And it's also the fact, like you said, if you're not taking care of you, it's going to be hard to take care of others. And it's okay to have an exhausting day and to go home and say, I just need a mental break. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah. It's so true. When I started implementing that in my own life, like the exhausting days, I would have with my son. It would be like, oh my gosh. And at the end of the day, I'd be processing through everything I did wrong or didn't do, or what did I not say, or how to. Sometimes I just had to like turn it off. And once he was in bed, just be like, no, I'm just not going to think about it tonight. I'm just going to take a break. And that's okay. I love that you said that, because giving yourself permission to, yeah, refill your cup is so important. So where can everybody connect with you after this episode online?
So there are two websites, depending on what you're looking for. So the Lotus Center for Special Music Education is more if you're looking for like what we do in terms of, you know, our educational philosophies and everything. And that's lotuscenter.net. And it's Center the Canadian Way. So it's TRE.net. And our Professional Development Institute is just institute.lotuscenter.net. And that's where we have all our previous webinars. We have mini courses, and we're launching intensive courses in the fall too, for those teachers that really want to dig in and commit some serious time to learning more about working with students with exceptionalities.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'll put both of those links in the show notes, and thank you so much for coming on this episode. This has been a great conversation.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, hey there. Thank you so much for listening into the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. There is an exclusive Facebook group just for listeners of this podcast and any elementary music teacher called the Elementary Music Teacher Community Facebook group. Come on over and join us there, where we have conversations around the podcast episodes and encourage each other each and every week. And also head to my website, thedomesticmusician.com. I have some free resources there that you can download to help you gain traction in your classroom today, as well as the blog and the membership site and all kinds of other goodies to help you keep going in your music teaching journey. I cannot wait to keep connecting with you and encouraging you and spurring you on in your journey of teaching elementary music. Hang in there, have an amazing week, and I will see you soon.